You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, an Olympic athlete at Marquette University, what's once known as the fastest human on Earth. We'll hear about the career of Ralph Metcalf.
First, local officials held a town hall meeting in Chippewa Falls last night about methamphetamine, also known as meth use. The drug is an illegal addictive stimulant that can be smoked or taken in pill form. Meth was so popular in 2005 that lawmakers created legislation limiting the sale of cold and allergy products containing pseudoephedrine, an ingredient used to make meth. While the law severely limited local production of meth, the drug never completely went away, and in the last couple of years, meth use has again been on the rise.
Larry Winter joins us now to talk about this trend in northern and western Wisconsin. He's the director of Chippewa County's Department of Human Services. Larry, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you. I enjoy the opportunity to speak with you.
Well, from your position at Human Services in Chippewa County, what are you seeing in terms of resurgence in meth use in your area?
I would equal it to being as significant if you could imagine that there was a virus outbreak. We had no idea that it was coming. It began to gradually spread and became an epidemic. And right now in Chippewa County, it is an epidemic. And the challenging part of that is not having the vaccine or the antidote to really contain this from continuing to spread.
What kind of efforts are there to try to contain this problem? As you say, there's no magic solution here, but what kind of things are in place?
Well, initially, obviously, when we looked at it, you know, it's against the law. And we began to intervene at a couple different levels, one with law enforcement and our local drug task force, and then our child welfare system, which is through Human Services, when there were specific children involved in those families.
Yeah, let's follow up on the issue of children. What has the impact of meth use in your area been on children?
Well, in Chippewa County back in, I think it was around 2005, we had an issue with meth, just like other areas around the state were. At that time, we didn't know what the degree of the effect that it really had because there wasn't a lot of research, there wasn't a lot of knowledge at that time. Well, moving forward here now 11 years, we do know a lot more. And one of the things that has been startling is by a child being in the home, they can be exposed by basically touching their parent, where the parent may have some substance coming from their skin, being in the environment, like when smoking, when you take secondhand smoke in. So we're testing babies. We're testing kids 3 to 5 years old, as an example, and they are coming up positive for meth. And that's the biggest thing that is a difference from what we know now that we didn't know then.
We hear in a lot of the state, in the southern and eastern parts of the state, that heroin is the big problem. We're hearing now meth, a rising problem in the western and northern parts of the state. Is there any idea why that's the problem where you are?
Well, what we've been able to narrow down to at this point, as far as the knowledge we've been able to gain, is we do know that there is some manufacturing going on in our area in Chippewa County. However, it's small compared to the way in which it's being brought in to Wisconsin and specifically Chippewa County. A source of it is the Mexican cartel. And that comes up through the interstate system, through the Minneapolis, into Chippewa County, being we're close to that border of Minneapolis.
As I understand it, back, as you mentioned, in 2005 when this was a problem, it was much more homegrown, people with labs in the woods or houses or elsewhere. That's not as much the case now?
Correct. That's what's been the most challenging thing about the current issue is back then we knew that you know, we found Sudafed, as an example, as being something that was what they were using to manufacture. And there were some laws enacted that didn't allow certain medications like that over the counter to be allowed to be just out in the open for people to purchase. What's different about that this time is there is less manufacturing going on within the county borders. However, the Mexican cartel, where the source of this is coming from, it's much more pure. And basically, when an individual does it once, what's different about this one is that you are immediately hooked. And that is a significant thing because of the different source of where the methamphetamine is coming from.
We're talking to Larry Winter, director of the Chippewa County Department of Human Services. And Larry, Governor Walker had a roundtable on meth when he was on the road last month. What kind of things came out of that meeting?
Well, first of all, it allowed the officials from the state, who we were very glad and gracious that they could attend governor's cabinet. So we had the Wisconsin Department of Children and Family Secretary, as well as the interim secretary at the time for the Department of Health Services. And what we had the opportunity to do, because they were much more familiar with opium than meth, so we had a venue in which to educate them about the drug, the impact that it's having on our area, and talked about what are some of the solutions that we would need to take a look at in regards to helping people who now are addicted.
As we mentioned, there was a town hall meeting about meth in Chippewa Falls just last night. What kind of things came out of that?
Again, it was brought forward that we had an opportunity to educate our entire Chippewa County. We were very impressed and satisfied. We had over 170 residents from the Chippewa Falls area attend that session. And what we came away with, again, is indicating to people to know what to look for, how to look for it, what to look at in regards to the areas that it might be an issue for their own children. Because one of the new budding events that's happened now is it is starting to become an issue on the juvenile justice side of things, where youth are involved in it. So it also then gave us a venue to say this cannot be done by just more of the formal systems. And what I mean by that is human services, law enforcement, schools. This is going to take a community coming together in Chippewa County and really focusing on this, becoming aware, becoming educated, reporting what they're seeing, so that we can look at some proactivity around the issue to stop the epidemic.
When it comes to opiates in this state, there's been a growing consensus, I think, that we can't just arrest our way out of these problems. It's not just law enforcement. There have been things like drug courts, more emphasis on treatment and prevention, things like that. Are you seeing similar efforts when it comes to meth?
Yes, we are. And your comment, in fact, last night came up from one of our judges here and had been spoken to me a couple weeks ago, is that we have realized with the number of kids, the number of parents, we aren't going to be able to just punish our way out of this. The challenge is people that are in the field that treat individuals with substance abuse issues, there isn't a lot of treatment that we know from an evidence-based standpoint that's effective. However, we do know of one model that is titled Matrix model that does work. There are a number of people specifically in Chippewa and more generally in this region going to learn more about that model in the month of September. And so we look at that as an opportunity. We also look at the opportunity like we did last night. We intend to have three more town hall meetings outside of the Chippewa Falls area to educate our more northern communities. And by making people aware of this issue and what to look for and what to look for in the people that they may be interacting with, we are anticipating and hoping that can be some of the efforts to intervene much more quicker than we have been able to at this point, and help people that are considering it to understand the consequences on their children, long-term consequences for themselves if they don't have children, and how it will affect their bodies.
We'll leave it there, Larry. Thanks so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure, and thank you.
We've been talking to Larry Winter, director of the Chippewa County Department of Human Services. He joined us to talk about the rise of meth use in northern and western Wisconsin over the last couple of years and the local response to that problem. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, a look at a legendary African-American Olympic athlete with strong ties to Wisconsin.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
The unaccompanied harmonies and ringing chords of barbershop music was very popular in the early 20th century. You can still find barbershop quartets today, but few as unique as Vintage Mix. 15-year-old quadruplets with a deep love of 1940s music.
I'm Annika. I'm the third born.
I'm Ian. I'm the first born of the group.
I'm Kelsey. I'm the second born.
I'm Julia, and I'm the baby of the family.
So in fourth grade, we sang at a talent show at our school, and then we did it the next year, but we hadn't really been singing then, and we went down to Nashville in seventh grade, and then we worked with a vocal coach, and that's kind of when we started to sing. We listened to 40s music and music from the past as children, and we really liked that music, but I'd say in seventh grade, so about 2 years ago, that's when we really first started singing and being musical.
Ba-ba-da-ba-da, ba-ba-ba-da.
We've actually only been performing formally with Barbershop for about a year when we sang a Barbershop song for our solo ensemble last year. It's a lot of blocked chords, and it has an emphasis on a dominant seventh, which is a type of chord, and Barbershop, yeah, it's a very distinctive era or style when you hear it. And just once you sing Barbershop, you kind of get the Barbershop bug, as we call it.
Just like a toy balloon.
A toy balloon.
You and I.
Just growing up when listening to this, we learned things like back in the 40s was when the war was going on, and people really turned to the music as a way to escape all of that. So it's all upbeat music. We really enjoy all the artists who perform in that era, and we really enjoy that music.
We really hope our audience enjoys the songs that we sing, and because we love to perform at retirement homes, we really hope we're able to bring that music back for them, and we hope they enjoy it as much as we enjoy singing those songs.
I would say my favorite event we have done would be the USS Milwaukee, which is the ship that had gone out from Lake Michigan, and it was such a neat experience. We got to go on the deck of the USS Milwaukee, and we just got to sing for so many great people, and it was such an amazing experience.
You've got a friend in me.
Our friends, actually, a lot of people at our school don't really know what we do. They just know that we sing together. So, yeah, a lot of people, I guess, it's kind of more people on the outside know what we do instead of people at our school.
Sometimes if I've had a bad day, I look forward to performances where I can just get away from all my school stuff and I can sing and enjoy what, or I can sing and do what I like to do.
Yeah, so. And the thing about doing like any type of music is if you're having a bad day, like doing music with your friends is like the best thing that can help you to lift you up and help you. Because like there are some times when I'm just in choir and I'm having a bad day, and then I just feel so like 180 switch, completely different after I get out of choir. So music in general just helps you when you're having a bad day, or helps you feel better.
And sometimes when we go to retirement homes and like the Stars and Stripes honor flights, when you see the expression on everyone's faces, it really brightens your day.
And there are some vets that like when we sing 40s music, they sing all the words with us. They know all the songs.
They'll start dancing.
Really cool. Yeah, it's really cool.
You got a friend in me.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton.
Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, track and field events are in full swing in the Summer Olympics in Brazil, and a former UW athlete, Evan Yeager, won the silver medal today in the 3,000-meter steeplechase.
He's not the first Wisconsin athlete to make a splash in Olympic track and field events. Back in the 1930s, Ralph Metcalf was a student and athlete at Marquette University. He won medals in the 1932 Olympic Games. He then made history as one of the African-American athletes to compete in the 1936 Summer Olympics in Berlin, Germany, being overshadowed by the amazing performance of his teammate, Jesse Owens.
After the Olympics and his time at Marquette, Metcalf went on to serve in the military in World War II and then into a life of public service, ultimately serving in Congress.
James Martin joins us now for a look at Ralph Metcalf's time in Wisconsin. He's a professor and chair of history at Marquette University. Jim, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Well, Ralph Metcalf was known as the world's fastest human for a while. Can you talk a little bit about his athletic achievements while he was there at Marquette?
Well, he was here for a long time. He started school in Milwaukee in 1930, and he graduated in 1936. And he was well known as a track runner, both as in intercollegiate competitions, but also AAU competitions. And he ran against the best sprinters in the country in both the 100 and the 200-meter and relays, and won a number of events in national competitions. He was one of the first ones to win the 100 and 200 AAU competition a couple of years in a row. So he was really well-known as a student at Marquette.
He ran against some of the world's best runners, and he beat some of the world's best runners, right?
He did. One of my favorite pictures that I have from Marquette's archives is one of him actually beating Jesse Owens in a track meet held in the old track over in western west side of Milwaukee.
Now, that's at Marquette. He also participated in, was it two different Olympic Games in 1932 and 36?
Exactly.
And what kind of medal did he bring home from those?
He won medals in both Olympics. He won gold medals in the 4x100-meter relay. He won a silver in the 100-meter in both Olympics. I believe he won a medal in the 200, at least one of them. So he was, if you see a picture of Jesse Owens winning the 100-meter dash at the 1936 Olympics, Metcalf is right behind him.
And because of those 36 Olympics, Jesse Owens rightly is well-remembered. But do you think Ralph Metcalf was maybe, by history, unfairly overlooked?
Well, I don't know if it's unfair or not. We tend to think of the people who win, even if it's by 0.02 seconds. And so that's just kind of the way sports is, I think. So I'm not sure it's unfair. But certainly he's remembered around here. I think that's the important thing, partly for his athletics. He's also well-known as a politician in Chicago after his athletic career. He was an alderman and a longtime congressman and quite active in the civil rights movement, the Black Congressional Caucus, and things like this. So at Marquette, we remember him both for athletics because, for obvious reasons, we actually have a Metcalf lecture held every year here at Marquette in which visiting scholars come and talk about racial issues of various kinds.
Yeah, for an African-American accomplishing what he accomplished at the time, even if he had never stepped out onto an athletic track, he'd be a noteworthy figure just for his life in public service, it sounds like.
I certainly think so, yes.
We're talking to James Martin. He's professor and chair of history at Marquette University, looking at legendary Olympian athlete Ralph Metcalf with a strong Wisconsin connection, his years at Marquette University. Talk a little bit more about how Marquette University remembers and honors him today. You mentioned that lecture series, for example.
That's really the main way. I mean, we often have one of these lecturers, and one of the things in the history department, and one of the things that we do, will give them a framed picture of Metcalf beating Jesse Owens. And so it's kind of a fun way of remembering the athletic side of him. But whenever he's introduced, whenever we invite people, and these are scholars from many different fields coming to Marquette, we make sure they know who we're talking about. And usually they've not heard of him for probably the reasons we mentioned before. He didn't win at the Olympics. We've had one or two who follow track very closely over the years and recognize his name. But I think what's nice about this is that it's an academic way of honoring him as opposed to a purely athletic way of honoring him. And so it brings which is pretty rare in higher education these days. It brings athletics and the academics together into one lectureship series.
In the piece you wrote for the Marquette University website, you mention a movie that came out, I think it was earlier this year, called Race, that focuses on Jesse Owens. And there it sounds like Ralph Metcalf didn't get quite the attention he might have merited in that movie.
No, I didn't see the movie. He seems to be, from the stills I've seen and what I've read about it, kind of background. There is an actor credited with playing him, but it's not a major role, no. Although they were friends. They remained friends all their lives.
As we wrap up, do you have thoughts on Ralph Metcalf and Jesse Owens and the other African-American athletes at that Berlin Olympics in 1936 and some of their historical significance as we look back?
Well, we've always looked at the Olympics as being a... it was meant to be a showcase for the Aryan race. Hitler is chancellor at this time and dictator by this time, and he stages the Olympics as a way of justifying his racial ideas about the superiority of northern white Europeans, basically. And it's before the major efforts to first isolate and then eliminate Jewish people, just for one of the groups that he attacked, for instance. But what I've learned fairly recently that Owens and Metcalf replaced two Jewish runners on the 4x100-meter relay team, partly out of, I think, fear of the safety of their runners. But the fact that Owens is always the one held up here as the example, but the fact that someone who did not fit into Hitler's racial ideology and theories did so well, and there are other examples too, certainly was seen at the time and ever since then as a challenge to Hitler's developing ideas about race and superiority.
Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Again, my pleasure.
That was James Martin, professor and chair of history at Marquette University. We were talking about legendary Marquette athlete and Olympian Ralph Metcalf. Later in the show, we'll ask about your favorite moments from this year's Olympic Games.
Coming up, we talk about the decline of barbershops as a vital part of social life for many men. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up at 7 o'clock tonight, it's the storytelling show Snap Judgment. Tonight, a show about keeping secrets called The Weight of the World.
First, the barbershop holds a special place in American memory. The red, white, and blue striped pole outside a shop filled with conversations and the smell of aftershave is something you either have firsthand experience with or you might just know it as that cultural reference.
Despite seeming like a familiar sight to lots of people, barbershops as we know them are on the decline. Between 1992 and 2012, the number of barbershops in the United States fell by about 23%. So what's replacing barbershops and who still goes to the ones that are starting to seem like a thing of the past?
Joining us now is Kristen Barber. She's an assistant professor of sociology at Southern Illinois University, Carbondale. Her new book is called Styling Masculinity, Gender, Class, and Inequality in the Men's Grooming Industry. Kristen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Before we get into the trends, what led you into looking at barbershops, into a window, into our society, and I guess into the society of men in particular?
Yes. Well, I actually, when I began research on, issues of beauty and gender, I was largely interested in women. But so much has been done on women. There's a lot of really important scholarship out there about how women go to beauty shops in order to create community and to, you know, shore up their appearances to sort of attempt to approximate, you know, definitions, ideal definitions of femininity. But there is little research on men and very, very little research on men in barbershops. And so when we're talking about sort of, you know, historical American sex-segregated institutions like beauty shops and barbershops, my work was really focused on sort of evening that out.
what was the barbershop like in its golden age? What role did it play in the lives of men?
Yes, well, the barbershop has been has a long history. There were barbers in ancient Rome who would hang out in squares and wait for men who wanted the stubble shaved off of their chins. But in more recent history, the barbershop has played a really important role in the creation of community for men. These are what sociologists call homosocial spaces or sex-segregated spaces. And so they're very interesting sites to study to see what sorts of things men talk about, what sorts of relationships that they create. And the research on barbershops focuses mostly on the Black barbershop and the importance that the Black barbershop plays in the Black community. Specifically, research shows that Black barbers will often serve as mentors to younger men, that barbershops are places for the socialization of young men, that men will bring their sons to these places, and this is where young boys learn to become men. These are also places where the barber might give out a loan to people in the community. In Black barbershops, they're important places for the discussion of Black American politics or racial politics in the United States. And then also more recently, people have started to talk a little bit about the importance of barbershops and the role they play in men's health. In men's salons, which I talk about in my book, both beauticians or hairstylists and barbers talk about being akin to doctors and that they see men every 6 to 8 weeks. And this means that they might notice the changing in shapes of moles or things like this, and they might be able to point out changes in men's health. And so the barbershop has played a really important role in creating community and close, intimate relationships between men in particular.
Are we seeing a decline in, barbershops for men over time?
Yes, we absolutely are. Really interesting, the census tracks the number of barbershops as businesses or enterprises. And since 1992, we have seen a decrease of about 23%, a slight uptick in 2013, and we'll need more numbers to get an idea of what this might mean. My hunch might be that they represent the rise of sort of hipster barbershops that we're seeing popping up in cities.
Talking to Kristen Barber. She's the author of the book Styling Masculinity, Gender, Class, and Inequality in the Men's Grooming Industry. So the old-fashioned barber may be on the decline, hipster barbers too, and you've written that men's salons are becoming the more common option. Is that performing the same social role, though?
It doesn't. What's really interesting is that barbershops remain a really important place in communities, in Black communities, Latino communities, and even white working class communities. But in well-to-do areas, we're seeing a decline in the barbershop and more men's salons popping up. And these men's salons, I'm not talking about great clips and I'm not talking about sports clips. I'm talking about more high service or more high-end men's salons that offer men haircuts as well as manicures and pedicures. And there aren't really, barbers working in these places. They're hairstylists. And they're oftentimes women. And so men aren't really congregating in these hair salons and creating community amongst each other, but instead creating one-on-one relationships with their hairstylists.
People talk about the idea of the third space, a space that isn't your home, isn't your workplace, and that third space is declining a lot in the United States. Is the movement away from barbershops, at least for some groups of men, a part of that change in American society?
Absolutely. I absolutely think it is. Yes, there's lots of research on the decline of social ties and the decline of participation in community spaces, which is what barbershops have been. And the hair salon, I think for some men, especially white, well-to-do men, it absolutely represents a shift away from larger communities. But interestingly, men are able to create close relationships with women, which in other spaces might be stigmatizing. So a lot of my research participants, clients, talked about how you know, they weren't necessarily comfortable creating intimate relationships with women that might be conceived as sexual in some way, but that everybody has to get their hair cut. And so by going to these men's salons, they're able to create close relationships with women who aren't their wives or aren't their girlfriends, and that they felt that these were meaningful relationships, but not large community relationships like you might get in the barbershop.
And are we seeing more and more men, especially in that white middle class or well-to-do group, having the person they keep going back to again and again? It's kind of alien to me. My hairstylist usually is the place with cuts in the name that I'm driving by when I need a haircut.
Yes, I mean, the employees of men's hair salons report that the same men come to them about every 6 to 8 weeks. With the Great Recession, they said they saw men come in fewer and fewer times for maybe spacing their haircuts apart. But the men that I spoke with said that they would get their hair cut in a phone booth if they had to, as long as they could continue to get their hair cut by the same stylist.
As you look at other communities outside of the white middle class or well-to-do men, you mentioned that the barbershop still is continuing, maybe not thriving. Is it still playing that role? You mentioned among black men, yes. How about white working class men? Is that still a community site where you get together, you talk to the barber, you talk to the other guys there?
Yeah, you know, my assumption would be yes, but what is so interesting is that this despite how important these sites have been for community, there is really little research done on these spaces. So it's very hard to come across research on the white barbershop. And so that's actually something that needs to be studied. My assumption, though, would be yes, that in working class neighborhoods that you're going to see men congregate in these spaces in groups more than you would in upper class or well-to-do neighborhoods, the more research really needs to be done on that.
So what are we missing if we don't have this kind of space in our life, the third space, whether that's the barber shop or the diner where you just run into people or the bar where, you know, you're not meeting somebody there for a date or a planned outing, but you just show up and there's the people you know, the regulars you hang out with. What do we miss if we don't have that in our culture?
You know, it's so interesting because these are definitely you know, emotional and physical well-being is really affected by our social relationships. And so these are places in which we create meaningful social relationships. But when we're talking about homosocial spaces and the study of masculinity, we have to be careful because these can be very controversial spaces as well. Research on other sorts of, maybe not barbershops, but other places where men congregate, particularly I'm thinking like fraternities. There are also findings that suggest that, and these are also spaces in which, sexism or homophobia flourish, and that there's can be a problem when these spaces are not just sex segregated, but segregated by race and by class. So it's sort of a double bind. These can be important community spaces in which well-being is enhanced. They can also be places in which segregation along the lines of race, class, or gender continue to operate.
Now, having done all this research and looked so closely at grooming among men and the social setting in the barbershop, does that make you take a look at your own life, your own community, your own barber or salon yourself, and think a little bit differently about it?
It does. It absolutely does. I kind of bounce around from salon to salon myself, and at times when I go into these spaces, I find myself talking a lot with my hairstylist, and sometimes sharing really intimate details of my life. And then sometimes I wonder if I'm putting a burden on my hairstylist, you know, whether or not she really wants to hear this and make me feel better about things that I'm working through in my own life. But also I recognize that part of the reason I invest in my discussions with my hairstylist is partly because I'm not maybe involved in other communities where I might be creating these sorts of social ties.
Kristen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Kristen Barber. She's an assistant professor of sociology at Southern Illinois University, Carbondale. She talked to us about changes in barbershop culture and the rise of the men's salon. Her new book is called Styling Masculinity, Gender, Class, and Inequality in the Men's Grooming Industry.
Coming up, the Olympic Games are about athletic ability, but they're also surrounded by controversy. We'll ask whether or not you're tuning into the Olympics and what you do or do not enjoy about them. You can tell us what you think by calling 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. The Olympics are one of the greatest displays of athletic ability in the world, but sportsmanship isn't all that catches the world's attention when the games roll around. You'll often find headlines about doping, corruption, and how wildly expensive the Olympics are for the host city. And more recently, debates over the potential spread of Zika in Rio has been a top concern.
In spite of all that, a lot of people still love watching the Olympic events themselves and spend a lot of time tracking the latest medal counts and winners. So we want to hear from you. Have you been watching the Summer Olympics this year? What have your favorite moments been? Is there a sport that you make sure to watch every 4 years, whether it's in the summer or the winter games in the alternate cycle there? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tell us what Olympic games you've been watching. You could also post over at the Central Time Facebook page.
That's right. We're curious to know if you're still inspired by the Olympics or if you think maybe they're on the wane, that they need a reboot. Are you still watching them, getting inspired, looking forward to them, learning to love these athletes? Or do you think that maybe the Olympics are feeling a little bit like they need a freshening up, a reboot? Tell us what you think. 800-642-1234 is the number to call.
We heard from Kelly on Facebook who says, I watched as much as I could, but it has been frustrating waiting for hours and an indeterminate amount of time to catch the events I want. It'd be easier to know what time specific events would be covered rather than just a range of hours it might be on. Sometimes it means I tune out early or don't bother turning it on at all. Thanks, Kelly. I hope you catch the events that you want to watch. There has been a lot of Olympics on in my household. My kids have been glued to the Olympics pretty much since. It's kind of like a tradition. Every couple of years, we watch a lot of Olympics.
It's been a tradition growing up for me, and in recent history, I'm more of a Winter Olympics person, but this year I haven't watched as much, and I'm curious if people have loved the Olympics in the past and still love it the same amount, or whether they're a little less into it now than they used to be. What do you think? Dora Zuniga from Wisconsin Public Radio here said, yes, I'm watching. I love gymnastics and the inspiration and stories behind each athlete.
I think gymnastics is one that definitely draws a lot of people in. Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Dimitri with us in Milwaukee. Dimitri, hi.
Yeah, hi there. Thank you for taking my call. Appreciate
what do you think? Are you watching?
I am definitely watching, and I just want to say, you mentioned whether it needs a reboot or what have you. There's definitely a difference between the Olympics, which is an international event that's hundreds of years old, and different than, say, football or basketball or traditional American sports. So for the rest of the world, it's an incredibly moving and important sports event. So this is difficult because it's the American perspective, and this doesn't end up being the center of the universe. So I think we stay with the way it's been for since ancient Greece.
And Dimitri, do you have a favorite event to watch?
I think I'm with everyone else when I say gymnastics, but I don't know that you can beat volleyball for the amount of elite talent that's out there.
Dimitri, thank you so much for that. So he is someone who sounds like he's going to keep watching after the games themselves. Volleyball, I've caught a little bit of the team volleyball, not much of the beach volleyball. Soccer, given the composition of my household, it is half soccer players. We've watched a lot of women's and men's soccer in our house, too.
Dimitri, thanks a lot for that call. And we're going to go next to Gwen in Delafield. Hi, Gwen.
Hi. I've been watching just about any event that I can. So in the evening, I'm like glued to it. And then during the day, I'll check it online to see if I can get any video glimpses in that. I really like the stories, especially some of the other countries. I think we are always interested in our own country, but I'm also interested in some of the athlete stories, like the young man from South Africa. who was an expected, who ran and received the gold medal in first time, lane 8 in that 200 meter, I believe it was, won a gold medal. So I think that story was quite interesting. And his mother was prevented from running in the Olympics because of apartheid in South Africa. So I think those stories are fascinating.
Mm, and so, do you think you'll be sad when it's over?
Yes, I'm really into it this year more than other years. I don't know why.
Nice. Well, thank you for that call. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much. I've watched some of the track events just this morning before I left. My kids were, of course, watching, and I'm just amazed. I get exhausted watching sometimes. I think I would be kind of collapsing in a heap, I don't know, after about 20, 30 meters into the race trying to keep up with them.
Well, I think one is right. The stories that surround the Olympics are a big part of what I like about it. I remember reading this Olympics, the story of a cab driver whose son was in the Olympics, but who could not afford a ticket to see the sun. And so a woman got into the cab, they struck up a friendship, and she started a GoFundMe page, and he got to go to the Olympics. Yeah, it's a stories like that. And then, of course, the heart of the athletes, too.
We're taking your calls. What are you watching? Are you watching the Olympics this year? 800-642-1234. Is there a story you've been following, an athlete you've been watching, a sport that you just can't miss? We'll go next to Paul from Albany, New York. Paul, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What are you watching?
Well, I watched the steeplechase this morning, and an American won a medal, I think, for the first time since the 80s. And they talked, the commentators all talked about how the last time an American won a gold was in 1956. And if you watch the race, it was won by a Kenyan, and a Kenyan also won the bronze. And there were a couple of Ugandans and other Kenyans very close to the end. And it would have been nice if the commentators had pointed out that in 1956, when the last American won the gold, Kenya didn't compete. Uganda didn't compete. They were colonies, just like Jamaica didn't compete in those days.
Oh,
and
interesting.
One of the things the Olympics shows us is that decolonization around the world leads to a much more interesting sports spectrum when countries like Kenya can specialize in what they do best, which is long-distance racing, and countries like Jamaica can do what they do best, which is very short-distance racing.
Paul, thank you so much. That's an interesting angle, interesting perspective on that. By the way, not just any American athlete won. A former UW athlete, Evan Yeager, won that silver medal in that, I think it was the 3,000-meter steeplechase today. Thanks a lot for that call, Paul.
And you can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are you watching the Olympics this time around? Or are you like Christine at Wisconsin Public Television, who said she's tuning out this year for the first time ever? She says, the corruption and cheating did it for me. I feel it's highly glorified and needs a redo.
And we heard from Nigel in our operations center. Says there's a lot of scrutiny on the media, the broadcasters this year. But he says it's exciting to see Michael Phelps come back against the odds, do so well. And the real story, Nigel says, is Katie Ledecky and the U.S. women's the U.S. women's gymnastics team. Thanks for that, Nigel. How about you? What Olympic sport are you watching this year? 800-642-1234 is the number to call, 800-642-1234.
I was traveling when the Olympics started up, but one thing I did catch was the Michael Phelps mad face that went around the world.
A lot of things going viral in the Olympics this time.
Right,
yeah, the angry
really
face.
A social media Olympics this year for sure, and it's exciting to see people react to it along with the Olympics themselves.
A caller just called and couldn't stay online, said not watching American gymnast Simone Biles is really missing out. Yeah, the gymnastics, I haven't been able to catch as much of that as I would have liked. Again, my kids are all on top of that, but some amazing performances there.
Curious about summer versus winter Olympics, too. We're in a state that enjoys winter. I'm definitely a winter Olympics person. So we'll see how the Olympics do next time the winter ones roll around.
Well, thanks for your calls and comments. You can keep it going over at the Central Time Facebook page. Let us know how you are experiencing the Olympics or not, who you're following, what sport you're watching. Again, do that over at the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.